The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea Fella, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm teaching here this month while Gil is away, teaching at Spirit Rock. He's up there. I'm teaching a month-long retreat. And on Sundays this month, I've been discussing some of the teachings around wisdom that the Buddha offers. And one of the main definitions of wisdom in the suttas is an understanding of what is skillful and what is unskillful towards our beginning to wake up, to begin to free ourselves from suffering. And this term for skillful or unskillful is that the Pali term is kusala for skillful. Kusala is akusala, is unskillful. And the term itself has often been translated in a lot of different ways. One of the ways it's commonly translated, and in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations of the sutta, he uses wholesome and unwholesome. Another monastic translator uses good and evil. So what is wholesome for what helps us to progress on the path of waking up, and what is unwholesome, what is unhelpful for that path, what leads us towards suffering. But Tanasaro Bhikkhu, a monk that often comes here, I think he comes here about once a year to teach, and he's done a lot of writings and translations of the sutta, and he notices and he points out that the term kusala and akusala are often used with respect to, in the Pali, cultivating some kind of a skill, whether it's a musical skill or a craft of some kind. So that term itself is used in an everyday sense to mean skillful, to cultivate a skill. And I like this term, and Tanjeff points out that it really kind of points to the fact that the Buddha was saying that the cultivation of our mind is like cultivating a skill. When we cultivate a skill, in general, we need to kind of pay attention to what the context of our experience is, whether we're cultivating a skill in music or in some kind of a sport or a craft. We need to know what the conditions are that we find ourselves in. We need to pay attention to how we respond to those conditions, and we need to pay attention to what the results are after we've responded. And this very much describes how we need to relate to our experience in cultivating a skillful mind. So the question is, what is the skill we're trying to cultivate as we meditate? What is the skill? And essentially, the skill that the Buddha ultimately points to is cultivating a mind that is free from suffering. So the question then becomes, what supports that? What supports moving in that direction? And what would lead us in the opposite direction? So this exploration of skillful and unskillful, of kusala and akusala, is about this exploration of what supports a movement away from suffering. There's a teaching about this in one of the suttas called Wise View. The sutta itself is called Wise View. And the very first teaching in this sutta is about this understanding of what is skillful, what is unskillful, what helps us, and what harms us on this path. And he lays out some very specific actions that help us and some very specific actions that don't help us. And there are 10 actions listed that help us and 10 actions that harm us. And they're essentially a set of opposites. So I'll just talk about one set and kind of point to the opposite side. So in terms of what supports our movement away from suffering, there are three skillful actions he mentions. He mentions refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, and refraining from sexual misconduct. Now, these sound very like, you know, a thou shalt not from the Christian tradition. They just sound kind of like that commandment. But really, the context here we're talking about is what is skillful. What helps us to not land in suffering? So the Buddha points out, if you engage in killing, if you engage in taking what's not given, if you engage in sexual misconduct, this leads to your own suffering, to the suffering of others, to the suffering of both. It's not a skillful means. So it's not so much about right and wrong. It's more about what supports our freedom. In the second part of this, there are four aspects of speech that support our freedom from suffering. And they are refraining from lying, refraining from harsh speech, refraining from divisive speech, and refraining from idle chatter. And again, cultivating the skill of waking up to freedom from suffering. Now, I think it's interesting in this sutta, he moves from skillful action first to skillful speech second. And this, I think, begins to point to a more subtle kind of attention, because it's a little bit easier to refrain from bodily action than it is perhaps to refrain from unskillful speech. It takes a little more subtle attention to what's going on in our minds. The intentions, the movement of mind that comes out in bodily action is pretty obvious to us often. And we can actually kind of hold back our body from moving. Even if we're having aversive thoughts or angry thoughts at somebody, often we can hold back from a physical action on those thoughts. With speech, it's a little harder. So it's a little more subtle kind of observing we need to cultivate in speech. And he moves on then to actions of mind that are skillful and unskillful. The unskillful actions of mind are covetousness, essentially wanting what somebody else has, ill will, wanting for somebody to be harmed. And the third one is kind of interesting. It's a wrong view or unskillful view. So this teaching on wise view, it's kind of circular. It refers to itself in there in terms of how we view the world. So this teaching on wise view, I like to see or point to that it goes from the more obvious ways that we look at our experience from the action level down through speech and then down through looking at how our minds are working. And this, I think, points to one of the reasons why this wisdom is so powerful. I think Some of you may remember the first week I talked about wisdom. I pointed out that a little bit of wisdom or a little bit of understanding of the Dharma, a little piece of understanding the Dharma goes a long way if we apply it using our mindfulness in our daily life. And this little bit of wisdom that I'm talking about, understanding what's skillful, understanding what's unskillful, in cultivating the skill of freedom from suffering. Essentially, the same patterns that motivate our behavior in a kind of a gross way, motivate our speech in a little more subtle way, and motivate our mental activity in an even more subtle way. So just applying this simple observation of what helps me and what hurts me as I move towards freedom from suffering, it goes very deep into our minds. So we can continue to apply this at more and more subtle, more and more refined levels, looking at this question of what's skillful and what's unskillful. It even goes deeper in the teachings. In this sutta that I'm talking about, the Sutta on Wise View, he points next to, these are 10 actions I talk about. The very first part I mentioned is about the 10 actions to cultivate, the 10 actions to avoid. So they would be avoiding killing, avoiding stealing, avoiding sexual misconduct. And the other side of it would be killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. So those would be the unskillful actions. So they're completely balanced, these 10 actions. And he goes on then to point out that all of these actions are rooted in three qualities of mind. All of the actions, all of the unskillful or skillful bodily actions, all the unskillful or skillful mental speech, actions of speech, and these actions of mind, this covetousness, the ill will, and this wrong view, they are all motivated by something even deeper in our experience. And that is just a kind of a tendency towards greed, aversion, delusion on the unskillful side, or a tendency towards non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion on the skillful side. So this really points us back even deeper to look at what motivates our actions, what's underneath our actions. If there's a motivation of greed, aversion, or delusion, that will tend to land us or pull us in the direction of suffering. If the motivation is one of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it will tend to pull us away from suffering. So essentially, these looking at whether our experience is motivated by greed, aversion, or delusion, or non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, this is the most subtle way of looking at our experience to watch how we move, what the results are. Again, in this cultivation of a skill, looking at what the results are when we act out of greed, aversion, or delusion. So I want to talk a little bit more about intention, because this is a very subtle aspect of our experience, but it's possible to see it, it's possible to know it, and to understand it. Every action that we do, whether it's an action of our body, an action of speaking, or an action of our minds, everything that we experience comes from some kind of an intention. So, for instance, if you stand up, there's a reason why you stand up. And in bodily actions, it can actually be kind of, that's a place, an easier place to begin to see this intention. When we are getting ready to stand up, we can know we're going to stand up before the standing up has happened. And that's a touching into this intention. So if you can just, in your experience, see if you can know when you're going to move before you move, you've caught that intention to move. Likewise, if you can know you're going to speak before you speak, you've caught the intention to speak. The intention to think is harder to catch. It is possible to catch it. But I'll emphasize most firstly these first two of the intention to move and the intention to speak. So in this intention to move or to speak, the intention itself, the actual impulse to do something, that impulse itself is said to be kind of neutral. But accompanying it or going along with it is the reason why we are going to move or speak. So there are the two parts. There's the kind of impulse to move or to do or to speak, and there's the reason, the motivation. And this is essentially the key place that the Buddha pointed to as the place where we can unlock our minds from suffering. That in that seeing of the motivation, we may start to recognize whether it's skillful or unskillful. Are we motivated by some form of greed, of wanting things to happen, of wanting things to be the way we want them to? Are we motivated by some form of aversion, of wanting to get rid of things, of pushing things away from us because we don't like them? Or is there kind of a motivation of delusion, of just not connecting, not really knowing, not really understanding what's going on? In that seeing of that motivation, if you can witness this with mindfulness, you have the opportunity to change the course of the unfolding stream of your experience and head it towards freedom from suffering. If you can catch that intention or that and that motivation, you have the opportunity to choose, do I want to act on this? Or do I want to let this go? It's a very powerful point of choice. And moment by moment, we can, if we see these choice points, we can turn our minds towards freedom. This is the point of choice where the cultivation of skill happens. This is the only place we can really do it, is in this moment, in this present moment. In this present moment, we can reflect on our intention. In this present moment, we can hopefully witness our intention and choose skillfully. So this is really where we hone our skill, in the present moment, looking at our intentions. Now, there are times, of course, when we may find ourselves landing already in something, having made a choice that was unskillful. And the teachings aren't about, well, then beating ourselves up because we've made a poor choice in the past. They are, how do we relate now, skillfully, in the present moment, to the conditions we find ourselves in now, having made a bad choice in the past? How do we relate skillfully to that? There's another teaching that I talked about on, I think it was on Monday nights a few weeks ago, where the Buddha talks about to his 7-year-old son how to hone this skill, essentially. And he recommends, before actions of body, speech, or mind, before you make the action, check and see, will this be harmful? Will it harm me? Will it harm somebody else? And if it will harm, if you can see that it will harm somebody, then don't do it. And he goes on to say, if you're engaged in any action of body, speech, or mind, and while you're doing it, you see it's causing harm, stop. And he goes on to say, after you've done things, if you see they have caused harm, then you should undertake restraint in the future, and you should also talk to somebody about that. The term confession is used, actually. Open yourself up. Let somebody know you've made a mistake. When we do make that kind of an action, when we actually allow somebody to know that we've made a mistake, I think we're less inclined to go that way again. So in the moving in this direction towards skillfulness and away from unskillfulness, we're going to make mistakes. And there needs to be some kind of compassion towards ourselves for the mistakes that we've made. And not abandoning of this path of cultivating, basically saying, well, obviously I can't do this. That's not so skillful to just abandon the whole project because we've made a mistake. I mean, when you're learning to play the piano, if you make a mistake in the scales, do you give up and say, well, you know, forget it. I'm never going to be able to play the scales right? No, you keep trying. You keep going. So that's the way we approach this practice. We make mistakes. We learn from our mistakes. This is the part about looking at the results. What are the results? It's helpful to have a kind of a deeper looking also at what happens, particularly when we look back at something and we see that it's caused harm. We may have had some kind of, there may have been a good intention behind what we did. We may have acted out of our best knowledge of the situation. And still it causes harm. And so this is an opportunity for us to look at, was there some way in which this good intention was clouded by delusion? There's some way in which this good intention didn't actually see the whole picture, didn't really understand clearly, and learn from that. There's a beautiful kind of poignant story about this. It's by an environment. It's about an environmentalist, David Brower, who was the founder of the John Muir Institute. And he tells the story of one of his early explorations in understanding and as a naturalist. It says, at the age of 11, he collected some eggs of the western swallowtail butterfly and kept an eye on them as they hatched into caterpillars, which later turned into chrysalides. Finally, the first of the chrysalides began to crack open, and what Brower saw was this. The emerging butterfly struggled out, its abdomen distended by some sort of fluid that was pumped out over its wings as it hung upside down on a twig. Half an hour later, it was ready to fly, and it took off. As the other chrysalides began to crack, however, Brower decided to make himself useful. He gently eased open the crack to facilitate the butterfly's emergence, and they promptly slid out, walked around, and one by one dropped dead. He had failed to realize that the exertion he had spared the butterflies were essential to their survival, because they triggered the flow of fluid that had to reach their wings. This experience taught him a lesson he was still talking about 70 years later. What appears to be kind and is meant to be kind can be the reverse of kind. So learning from our experience. And if we have a good intention and see that it results in something that we didn't intend, digging a little deeper. What didn't we understand? So last week, the last couple of weeks, I've talked the entire time. And last week I promised I would talk shorter and leave longer time for questions and comments. So I think I'll stop here and see what kind of a discussion we can have.
Hi. I believe it was last week you used the term nirvana to refer to the state of mindfulness, advanced mindfulness. And I remember in the past, Gilles used the term awakening. I want to know if you could clarify the difference between those two terms.
Well, I'm not positive of how Gil was using it, but probably he was using it as an alternate translation for the Sanskrit term nirvana. So I was providing the Pali and the Sanskrit terms, nibbana and nirvana. And there are many different translations for those terms, awakening being one of them. Cooling or essentially release is another term that's often used. So I think it's just he was using an English version translation of the term.
Four times a year I go away on a retreat with police officers and firefighters who are suffering from catastrophic work-related stress. And I just came back from one. And amongst this group of people was a young man who was recently forced to take someone's life in the line of duty. And then prior to that, he had been in Iraq and was in combat and has probably killed, by his count, some 30 people, many of whom he knew not to be enemy combatants, but he was ordered by his superior. Their unit was under siege to just shoot anything that moved, and he did. He is not a Buddhist. he's very young, and he is suffering greatly from the things that he was forced to do, and I was trying to help him see himself as a victim of the tides of history that are bigger than all of us. But I'm wondering how you might either respond to him or what you might advise me. I will never see this man again, but I will see other men like him.
Yes, this is a very heavy burden for someone to carry, especially when they feel such suffering around it. I think it's a heavy burden in any case. I think when somebody doesn't feel that they're carrying it, it's kind of eating them inside as opposed to really being present on the surface. There's many things to say. There's so many things going through my mind, I'm having trouble sorting them out. The first one that comes on the surface of my mind is some form of healing ritual that may support a kind of a atonement for what he's done. We can't just ignore that stuff. I mean, it's like we can't just put it in the back and say, well, that happened and I just, have to not think about it and move on. We have to kind of work through the suffering around it. And some kind of atonement towards it can be supportive in terms of connecting to and letting go of the guilt. The guilt part, I mean, there's two qualities. One that's got a kind of an unskillful skew to it, and one that is actually skillful with respect to looking back at our unskillful actions. There's the idea of guilt, where we're basically essentially beating ourselves up and telling ourselves, I'm a bad person, and I'm never going to be a good person. that kind of guilt is not so helpful. Now, the quality of remorse, on the other hand, where we actually see, yes, this has caused suffering, and I'm grieved, I feel a sense of the suffering that I have caused. There's a sense of that in the body, in the mind. But can we move that towards in a direction towards change as opposed to holding on to what we've done in the past. There's a story in the suttas of a mass murderer who had killed 999 people. And I like this story because it really does point to the fact that even having killed 999 people, there's a path towards freedom. So this person met the Buddha, and the Buddha pointed out to him, basically, you know, in a kind of a intimate meeting of minds, the Buddha pointed out to him he needed to stop this action. And over the course of the next few months and years, he began to observe his mind and observe his mind in meditation and let go of all of that impulse towards greed, aversion, and delusion. Essentially, that's the movement that we have to pick up on here in the present moment. It's shifting our mind stream away from greed, aversion, delusion towards non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. And that movement will purify us as we move forward. It can purify pretty much anything that we've done. There are some caveats in terms of what the actual Buddhist beliefs are in terms of what you've done in this life that can be purified in this life and what would need to be purified in lives to come. The killing of your mother and father being one of those things that essentially you will suffer deeply over those. The killing of people can be purified in this life through a turning of the heart, a movement away from that aversion. And this story of this mass murderer in the time of the Buddha, he became completely enlightened in that life. And I take that as a very inspiring story of the possibility of the human mind to release itself and turn itself in the direction of freedom. So those are just a few thoughts. Mostly I would encourage, I think what you did in terms of reframing it is very helpful. But the part of the key is that hopefully to move in a direction where we then do not put ourselves in those situations in the future.
Well, I like the notion of the comparison of guilt and remorse, but then that what you just said raises another question. If this is your job in life, if you're a police officer, what then do you do because you are exposing yourself to the possibility that you may have to take another life again at some point in your career?
Yeah, that's another challenging issue, and we each have to make our own choices in this area. Now, the Buddha did recommend, and that the recommendation is if you have to harm someone, you do it essentially with as much compassion in your heart as you can. And hopefully, I mean, I know police officers are using tasers more, which can eliminate the need to actually kill. So, you know, there are possible ways to approach or to shoot in the leg as opposed to in the heart. Or, you know, it's a very, very challenging topic. And, you know, if you find yourself in a very strong conflict around this area, I mean, I think, you know, the Buddha would probably recommend not killing, even if this is in your line of duty. I mean, probably the Buddha might recommend, if I think about, you know, what the Buddha would say, it would be let go of that profession. So, you know, it's but we all have our own our own path, our own journey to follow. And if somebody feels strongly that this is a path that they're following for their own reasons, then bringing as much compassion to the situation as possible. And it's very clear teaching that the Buddha gives, that if you kill, you will suffer. Others will suffer. It's not going to support you. He doesn't call it evil so much. He just says it's going to lead you away from freedom. So there's a choice we make. It's a choice, and individually we need to look at this. The Buddha, in one other teaching that's kind of hard to grok or hard to understand in some ways, he talked about what the state of somebody's mind should be if somebody is sawing off your limbs. Now, if somebody's actually sawing off your limbs, you should be wishing them compassion for killing you. So, you know, he's got some things that most of us can't live up to, but that, you know, we need to just reflect. And again, we're in a point of, we're still practicing scales here, you know. We're at the beginning. We're making a lot of mistakes practicing scales. And looking in our own experience, what can we do? Where can we take the next leap? We can't get to the point where we're going to wish compassion for somebody sawing off our limbs like that. We have to take the steps that we can and work with the intentions that we have in this moment and bringing as much non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion in as we have access to, as much compassion as we have access to.
There was something that you said that I found confusing. I wanted to ask you about. You said a couple of times something about being motivated by delusion, and I found that confusing because I think I can't imagine anybody would choose to be deluded. I mean, don't we want to be? Don't all of us want to be more aware?
Certainly, we want to be more aware, but we are not always aware. And essentially, when we are not aware, there is the motivation of delusion, in a sense. I mean, it's not something we choose so much as it's just something that happens to us. And one of the main, and this, ooh, this is, do I have time for this? One of the main delusions that we operate under is kind of invisible to us. And we feel in many ways like we're being aware, and yet if we have the feeling that we are being aware, that I am aware, that I'm doing something, that I'm choosing, that it's me, that there's somebody in there doing that. If we're observing in that way with the sense of self-doing and experiencing, that is kind of the fundamental delusion that we all operate under, is this delusion that there's somebody in there doing and experiencing. That ultimately, really, what's happening is that, and this is really, you know, again, the refinement as we begin to see more and more clearly what's going on in our experience, as we begin to observe our experience, and particularly looking at intention. Looking at intention is a really clear way to start to see this, the fact that pretty much everything is just a flowing of causes and conditions and intentions. That's what's happening. And the intention itself, as we begin to observe the intention itself, we see that it's also caused by other things. And there's no one really motivating. I mean, that intention piece is sometimes a piece that we really hook to as being, I'm the one who is intending. That's a kind of a key place where we identify. And as we begin to observe our intentions and see that they're just arising out of causes and conditions and that they motivate us to act, just moving on the action. And if we don't see them, we simply will just act out of whatever that intention that has arisen in. If we actually witness it in the present moment, there's the opportunity for heading it in the in a skillful direction. But it's actually we don't head it in a skillful direction. The wisdom that comes from the seeing heads it in a skillful direction. So it's simply causes and conditions flowing and moving. And there's no one in here really doing. So any time you feel like you are someone. There is delusion operating, and you are probably motivated out of that. One of the main motivations we have is protect ourselves, right? And often this protection, there's kind of a bodily protection thing that will go on, kind of a natural survival instinct mechanism that goes on to protect the life that's going on in the body. But a lot of what we try to protect is a sense of identity, a sense of who we are, of wanting people to see us in a certain way, of wanting to be known to be someone special or whatever. There are ways that we hold on to and try to protect and defend some kind of identity. And that is really a huge delusion that's operating, because there's nothing to protect or defend in that area. Now, this is a huge piece of the wisdom teaching of the Buddha around this topic of not-self. And this is one of the topics I'm going to talk about next week. So I'll give you a little more on this next week. And it's time to stop. So thank you all for your participation.